Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mother of Death and Dawn by Carissa Broadbent, narrated by Esther Wayne and Dan Kelly. Prologue. Tell me, little butterfly, what would you do for love? The woman knows the tower now. She knows every angle of its imposing shape as it rises from the surf. She knows the way the walls carved into its surface feel beneath her palms. She knows how the bone-white stone looks smeared with her blood. She knows its scent, acrid and stagnant, like death itself. She knows everything, except for how to break it. This place has taken something from her, you see. Taken the most precious thing. Tell me, little butterfly, what would you do to get him back? Anything. Everything. The first time she tries, it is an act of pure desperation. She has conquered cities and defeated armies. She has ended wars. Surely she is powerful enough to do this. Now she does not need to conquer a city, just a single prison. She does not need to free a civilization, just one person. The stone strikes her down like a palm to a fly. Minutes and she is crashing back into the surf, pulled out again by friends who barely manage to escape with their lives. But the woman knows nothing if not how to fail. So she tries again, again, again. She collects another scar, another night of an aching heart, and a little more of her dies. She gets up and goes again. The last night is stormy and dark, the sort of night yanked from horror stories. Her friends beg her not to go. Wait one more day, they say. If the guards don't kill you, then the storm will. What's one more day, they say, after all of this? What's one more day? She would have laughed if she wasn't choking back sheer rage. One more day is 24 hours, 1,440 minutes, 86,000 seconds of torture for the man trapped within those walls. The storm is a monster. It is so dark she can barely see. The white tower of Ilizath lit only in garish blue-white flashes as lightning cracks the night. Rain shreds the air like silver blades. As always, she makes it to the prison. And as always, faster than they once did, the eyeless guards are upon her in seconds. She fights back, but there are many of them and only one of her. Her head smashes against the ground. Crack! The sky splits open just as her skin does, just as her heart does. She rises to her feet. Blood is in her eyes, staining the world crimson. And there, in that moment of desperation, she feels a sliver of the magic that had so evaded her for these last weeks, a flicker of a familiar soul, contorted in pain and buried within layers of stone. He is so, so close. It cuts something primal loose in her. The next time a blade opens her flesh, she doesn't feel it. She fights back like an animal. These are not people before her, they are obstacles. Obstacles keeping her away from her most precious person. Obstacles who dared deny her broken heart every time she came here, fighting for the queen that had put a dagger in her back. She becomes nothing but the desire to burn down the world that did this to him. Crack! Lightning illuminates flashes of blood, of opened bodies, of rotting flesh. Flashes of her own seeping wounds. She fights and fights and fights as tears stream down her cheeks. Tell me, little butterfly, what would you do for love? Part 1. Lost. Chapter 1. Tizana. He liked me. But then, of course he did. I anticipated his every need, every discomfort, every desire. I never stopped listening, never stopped watching. When I danced, I counted every footfall. Months had passed and my magic remained, for the most part, painfully out of reach. Once I had easily drawn from its deepest levels, making me a force of nature. Now, ever since the collapse at the Scar, I struggled to even use it at all. But I had learned that I didn't need it to be the perfect slave. I had gotten so good at being exactly what men wanted me to be. Lord Faramov smiled at me. It would have been a pleasant smile in any other context. He was not an unattractive man, with grey-streaked sandy hair and a warm face. Perhaps if I was someone else, a different someone else than the someone I pretended to be now, I might have thought he was kind. But I was not another someone. I was a slave. And Faramov perhaps seemed kind, but it was the sort of kindness that one bestowed upon a sweet dog. Even the kindest people corrected undesirable behaviour in dogs. I never needed to be corrected, and that was why his smile was so pleasant as I placed the plate of berries at the table. "Good, Rosa," he said. Rosa. My name, as it had been for the last 2 weeks. I gave him a demure nod as I straightened, pushing a sheet of smooth chestnut hair behind my ear. I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror in the movement. The face that stared back at me was unfamiliar, though if I looked closely I could find traces of the one I had worn my entire life. No fragmented skin, just smooth sandy tan. No silver hair, just deep chestnut. No scars. A slightly wider mouth, narrower nose, softer brow. Me, but not. The only thing that remained was the eyes. One silver, one green. Eyes, Ishka had said, were impossible to hide with any illusion, even with the advanced fey potions he had taken from Eladar. But no illusion was perfect, and no illusion could last forever. I had been wearing this one for too long. Every time I looked at myself, I half expected to see my own fragmented skin. I was supposed to be out of here days ago, but each time the Fae's visit to their Threlian allies was delayed, I thought to myself, I've stayed too long to give up now. I decided that the illusion would just need to hold up a little bit longer. I had spent weeks here, monitoring the rhythm of the household, waiting for this meeting. Faramov frowned down at the berries. The feast was something to behold, flowers and fruits and meats and cheeses. Maids flurried about the room, adjusting each detail of the display. "Do you think that Fae even like fruit?" he mused, to no one in particular. "I heard once that they only eat living flesh. Perhaps I should have gotten something alive." I imagined Ishka chomping down on live creatures and almost laughed. Ishka, who barely managed to hide his disgust at the very thought of eating something that had once been moving. "How could they not be impressed?" I said. "It is magnificent, and so clever, to showcase the best of every region of the Threlian Empire. A brilliant idea, and a feast worthy of royalty, my lord." Faramov puffed slightly with pride. He liked that I noticed what he had done with the menu. Impossible not to. The best of every region of the Threlian Empire really meant the best of all Threl has stolen from the nations they conquered. Nizrani's blood apricots were right there in the middle of the table, next to a vase of Derelin's cerulean blue blossoms. My gaze lingered on the flowers a little too long. An unwelcome image flashed through my mind. Max, holding those very flowers as the two of us sat alone at night in the Threlian plains. The night I kissed him for the first time. The night I let myself fall. And now he was... "My lord," a nervous-looking maid appeared at the door. "The Fae emissaries have arrived." I hadn't seen these Fae before. After months of war, one might think that I would have encountered more of them. But the Threlian and their slaves were far more common foes than the Fae. The two women were strangely, ethereally beautiful, as the Fae, I'd learned, usually were. One had dark hair that seemed to flash blue when the light hit it the right way, blunt to her shoulders. The other was taller, with sleek blonde hair that reached her waist, sharp cheekbones, and a piercing stare of gold that triggered a wave of recognition. Sometimes I almost found it amusing to watch the dynamics between the Threlians and the Fae. The Threlian lords were just so desperate to be seen as powerful. They loved the fact that the Fae came out of hundreds of years of hiding only to immediately propose an alliance. What was better validation of their egos than a race of near immortals choosing them as their sole human partners? So foolish. Ishka had told me plenty about the Fae King and his desire to destroy humanity. Sooner or later, once the Threlians outlived their usefulness to him, they would meet an end too. But in the meantime, the Threlians would provide the scale and numbers that the Fae lacked, and they would stumble and blush over their Fae allies. Faramov smiled and began to launch into a flowery greeting, but the blonde Fae cut him off. "This is my second, Nisieth Vared." She gestured to her dark-haired companion, then bowed her own head. "I am General Iashka Saez. King Kadwan has sent us. Forgive us if we have little time for pleasantries." "Saez." I kept my expression very still as I poured iced teas at the table. No wonder she looked so familiar. She was a relative of Ishka's. A sister? A cousin? Another couple followed them into the room. A tall man with sharp, dark eyes and fair hair, neatly slicked back, and a petite woman with enormous blue eyes and golden curls who looked like she could be a porcelain doll. They wore fine silk clothes. All white, of course. One glance told me they were Threlian power. Faramov's smile faded, eyes widening. "Lord and Lady Zorokov, what a surprise." I nearly dropped the pitcher. I was not prepared for the unwelcome deluge of memories. The smell of rotting flesh. The sight of a box of severed hands at my doorstep. The sound of the death screams the monster bearing it had given me. "The Zorokov family," the monster had whispered, "does not like being lied to." The Zorokovs had murdered hundreds of slaves. And all because of me. I righted the pitcher quickly, my knuckles so tight around the handle that they were white. No one noticed my fumble except for Lady Zorokov, whose doe-like stare fell to me.
"Goodness, are you all right?"
If I didn't know better, I might mistake that for genuine concern. "Yes, my lady," I murmured. "My greatest apologies." She cocked her head and smiled.
"Oh, look at that. You do have the most beautiful eyes, don't you?"
I lowered my gaze immediately. "Thank you, my lady." There were no fewer than 8 freshly sharpened dinner knives at the table right now. My fingers itched for them. Seconds and I could kill them both. I didn't even need my magic to do it.
"A welcome surprise, of course."
Lord Faramov was in the process of quickly correcting his less than overjoyed reaction.
"It is always a pleasure to receive a visit from you. A discovery like this deserves to be seen firsthand," Lord Zorokov said.
Faramov put his shock away for good and grinned.
"Wonderful. There is more than enough food. Come, sit, eat, and we shall..."
"We have no time for such comforts, I fear," Iashka said. "King Kadwan is quite impatient. Given the acceleration of Aran aggression, you must understand that time is of the essence."
"But what a shame to..." "Our deepest apologies, Lord Faramov," the dark-haired Fae, Nesiath, said, not looking particularly apologetic at all.
Faramov sighed, failing to hide his disappointment.
"Very well, of course, I understand."
He gestured to one of the slaves who crossed the room and returned with a polished mahogany box with a gold latch. It was modestly sized, smaller in length and width than the dinner plate Varimov moved aside to place it on the table. The carvings on its surface had been partially eaten by time, despite its obvious, careful restoration. Utter silence. The breath seemed to have left everyone in the room at once.
"This is it?"
Yashka said quietly.
"It is. My collection of artifacts are quite extensive, you see. It took months of searching to locate this, but alas..."
He unclasped the box and opened it. There, in a bed of black silk, sat a glass orb. Mist swirled within it like storm clouds, subtle and yet eerily unsettling. The hairs stood on the back of my neck, a strange sensation nagging deep inside of me. It was the sort of gut feeling I hadn't gotten in months, not since my magic eluded me after the Aran War.
"So this is the thing that King Kadwan lays so many hopes upon," Lord Zorokov murmured, transfixed.
Yashka said nothing. She reached out to touch the orb, and sparks and clouds collected under the glass beneath her fingertips. I tried not to let my interest show, turning away as I swallowed my uncertainty. This thing did not look like a weapon. A magical curiosity, perhaps, but not a weapon. The two Fae exchanged an unimpressed glance that seemed to betray the same thought.
I have others too, Varimov said, sensing their disappointment. Many other artifacts, some of the greatest treasures in all of Threl. Perhaps they, too, are of value to your king.
And at this moment I felt a telltale burning at my fingertips. A pit of dread grew in my stomach. I casually glanced down to see a flicker at the tips of my fingers. Smooth skin and my fragmented Valtaine skin shuddered alternately in and out of view. Shit! Shit! Not now! It was the worst possible timing for the illusion to start falling away. Hands would be easy enough to hide, but I had maybe half an hour before the disguise disintegrated completely. Less than that before it became obvious that something was not right about my appearance. I clasped my hands behind my back and donned my most charming voice. "Lord Varimov owns the rarest collection of artifacts in Threl," I said. "Many were even recovered from the same tombs as this one." Varimov beamed. He was so eager to show off his treasure that his pride outweighed any displeasure at a slave speaking out of turn. And, just as I knew it would, this statement caught the Fae's attention.
"Very well," Yashka said. "We shall see them." "A gift to you," Varimov said, leading them out the door. "Anything you please."
The minute the footsteps softened down the hall, I crossed the room and opened the box. The other slave, Melina, I thought her name was, lurched forward, eyes wide.
"But..."
"Shh!" I gave her a look, sharp enough to make her mouth snap closed, and opened the box. Our spies had heard so many stories about this. This artifact that Caduaniero, the mad Fae King, was so desperate for. We didn't know what it was or what it did. Even the Fae's Threlian allies, it seemed, did not know that. But the fact alone that it was so desperately sought after was enough to make Ishka adamant that it could not fall into the hands of the Fae or the Threlians. Whatever it was, we had theorized, I might be able to make use of it, given my connection to the deep magics that Kadwan manipulated. A stretch, considering that over these last months I could barely use any magic at all. And this, selfishly, was my only thought, as I looked down at this magical trinket. I had dreamed of something powerful enough to break down the walls of an ancient prison and tear down one of the greatest militaries in the world. I had dreamed of something powerful enough to bring the one most important person in the universe back to me. This glass orb did not look like such a thing.
"Rosa!"
Melina whispered nervously. I ignored her as I reached out to touch the sphere. The next thing I knew, my back slammed against the floor. My breath hit me like a stone crashing down on my chest. And my skin was burning, burning, burning so intensely that I had to bite down hard to keep from letting out a cry. My skin! My hand! Rosa! Melina fell to her knees beside me. Long seconds, and the pain subsided to a tolerable throb. I forced my eyes open and bit back a gasp. Gold covered my fingertips, reaching down over my palm in organic shapes that looked like the veins of a leaf. The strokes were slightly raised, and my skin clung to the edges, irritated where the gold met my flesh. This wasn't on me. This was in me. I lifted my eyes to the box on the table. It was now empty. Oh, gods. I looked at the gold spreading across my palm with renewed horror. This thing. This was the artifact. Melina made a strangled sound of panic and suddenly pulled away from me. It took me a moment to realise why. I had been so preoccupied with the gold that I hadn't realised what it was covering. My skin. My normal, fragmented skin. The illusion was gone. Melina turned to the door, presumably to get help. I moved faster. I leapt to my feet, grabbed her, and pressed my hand to her mouth. "Don't move," I hissed. "I am one of you." Her back was against me, my arm firmly around her shoulders to keep her from moving. I could not see her face, but I felt her trembling. "I am Tizana Vitezic," I whispered. "Do you know that name?" A pause, then a small nod. "I need you to tell me how we can get out of here, Melina. Fast. Quietly." She jumped a little. I knew why. The we. That one word made life much more difficult, especially since I barely knew this girl. But I couldn't leave her alone here to face the consequences of my escape. Slowly, I removed my hand from her mouth, though I didn't release her just yet, just in case.
"We can't," she whispered. "There's too many people here now, in the middle of the day."
"There has to be something.
Can't you just use magic?"
I almost laughed. I knew what she was thinking. This girl has ended wars and she can't get herself out of this stupid house. I spent a lot of time lately thinking about my magic and all the things it couldn't do.
"No," I said, "not here. There are too many wards."
Farimov's estate, like those of many of the Threlian lords, had been protected with many, many stratagram wards since the beginning of the war. Protection against magic-wielding rebel slaves like myself, and against Nura's armies. I tried not to think about the fact that if I still had Reshe, I could tear through those wards easily. If I still harboured a connection to deep magic. I shook the thought away. Unhelpful. I reached into my pocket and folded my fingers around the gold feather there. Ishka was not prepared for me now. Under the original plan, I was to call for him at night, when I could make it past the strongest of the wards, and he would fly me out of the estate. This escape would be much more difficult now, in the middle of the day. Still, he was our best chance of making it out of here alive. I pulled out the feather and dipped it into the candle flame. Ishka would feel its call, but I had no idea where he was right now, or even if he would be able to get to us in time. "The servants' tunnels," I said. "Will they get us out of the house?"
"They aren't really tunnels. More like a basement. And they don't go as far as the estate walls. They just need to take us outside."
The feather was now a dusting of ash, which I hastily brushed under the table runner. Weapon. I needed a weapon. A decorative sabre hung on the wall, which I yanked free as quietly as I could. It was a gaudy thing, the hilt covered in impractical rubies. The blade was dull. It was clearly never intended to be used for actual combat, but if I stabbed someone with it hard enough, it would do some damage. "Let's go." I was already at the door before I realised that Melina was not with me. I turned to see her standing still, eyes wide, lips parted but releasing no words. She looked so utterly terrified. Is that how I had looked, I wondered, when Cyril put me on that horse and told me to go find a new life? I never would have said it aloud, but back then I had been so frightened of leaving everything I had ever known.
I dealt with it by drowning myself in my obsession with the future I swore I'd create.
But, uninvited, the memory settled over me. The snap of a fire in cool night air, a familiar scent of ash and lilac, a little sarcastic laugh, a smile that started on the left side first. Home. I had never thought I would find a home, even if it had been a temporary one. My chest ached and my stance softened. I returned to Melina, taking her hand in a firm, comforting grasp.
There are lots of people like you, I said quietly. Like us. If we make it out of here today, you'll be amazed at what freedom can be.
She gave me a weak smile and swallowed hard.
This way.
Chapter 2. Max. It's not all that hard to keep yourself sane, so long as you're flexible with your definition of the term. It's just a matter of finding one solid thing, one constant. Numbers were perfect in theory, at least in the beginning. 3 always came after 2, always came after 1. It never changed. And yet, when you have nothing in your life but those numbers, it's so easy for them to unravel before you. Does 3 really come after 2? Does 1,706 actually follow 1,705? This was the problem with the numbers. They were too intangible. That was why I think I started with the drawing. I say the drawing because there was only 1. 3 shapes, always in the same arrangement. And I say I think because I couldn't recall when I started drawing them or why. Only that it was the only thing my hands felt right doing. Maybe the shapes meant something in a dream once. Maybe they meant something in a memory. Both were equally hazy now. Now I lay on my stomach, left hand flat against the cold ivory stone of the floor. Everything in here was the same. Ivory floor, walls, ceilings. Ilizath was a dead place. Everything was empty. The air was eerily silent, Ilizath's magic choking back every sound. The walls were bare save for the carvings etched into them. No windows, not even a door. When people did come here, the opening simply stepped out of the stone, and it was gone again as soon as they were. The white was torturous, so bright and dark at once that it seemed to burn my eyes, but it was preferable to the alternative. My other hand clutched a little piece of metal, just sharp enough to etch into the stone. I knew Ilizath well enough by now to know that the moment I took my eyes away from this drawing, it would be gone when I looked at this spot next. Ilizath had a way of erasing any mark its prisoners tried to make on the world. Maybe it was my petty act of defiance then. The drawing was the same every time, a cluster of 3 shapes, always in the same arrangement. 1 lopsided circle to the left, another slightly lower to its right, and a 3rd, longer shape beneath the first. The 3 of them together forming a triangular formation of patches. In the beginning, I would wonder what they were. Now I figured it didn't even matter. The air shifted, and I froze. I knew this feeling by now. A pit formed in my stomach, and I dutifully ignored it. My eyes trained on the markings I etched into the floor, even as the room darkened. I would not look. I would not fucking look. Sweat prickled at the back of my neck. A red cast suffused the room. The snap of flames grew unnaturally loud.
Max.
I knew that voice. I knew it even though still I didn't understand who it belonged to. And yet the sound of it still made my eyes snap up, no matter how many times I told them not to. The sight of her was just as horrifying as it always was. The girl was perhaps 11 or 12. She had long, sleek black hair and a demeanor that seemed so familiar in more ways than one. Also, most notably, she was on fire. Sometimes she was weeping as she crawled across the ground to me. Sometimes she was furious, trying to strike me. Today she just stood there, almost serene, as chunks of flesh melted off her face. She looked sad.
"Why did you do this to me?"
she asked.
"Why would you of all people do this to me? Those were my last thoughts, you know. It hurt worse than any of this."
She gestured weakly to her burning body, and there was something there, just for a moment, some shard of a memory that kicked me in the gut, gone before I could wrap my fingers around it. Or maybe I stopped myself before I let myself remember.
I looked away. You're not real, I muttered. Yes, I am. Nothing in this place is real. You're just another nightmare.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?